and welcome to the CAAV podcast. After 4 months of political uncertainty, three prime ministers, four cabinet reshuffles, and subsequent total stagnation in practical government activity, the wheels are again starting to turn. As DEFRA Secretary Therese Coffey has unveiled a little detail on forthcoming environmental schemes, and following Chancellor Jeremy Hunt's financial statements last month, Jeremy Moody, Secretary and Advisor to the CAAV, joins me to consider the outlook for farmers and the rural economy. So Jeremy, farmers have been calling for some semblance of certainty over future environmental schemes, and Therese Coffey gave us a glimpse of what's to come at the CLA conference and more recently the Environment Committee. So what really stood out to you?
The first thing that stands out really is that we are, as you said, beginning to get decisions coming through from government generally and DEFRA in particular. As you say, the wheels of government starting to turn. But there is an awful lot of pending business across the spread of DEFRA policy that we deal with, from environmental targets and biodiversity net gain, right the way through to some of the granular detail of schemes, we are still waiting. What we have had, though, is the core conclusion from what at one point was being called the rapid review of government policy. And the core conclusion is that nothing in terms of objectives has changed. The government's policy remains what it has been actually for quite a number of years, which is an emphasis on improvement of farming productivity and improvement of the environment. And that twin track policy stands. What has been reviewed, and what was indeed the topic of the rapid review, were the means to try and achieve particularly perhaps the environmental stewardship side of this. And the conclusion that was announced to the CLA conference on the 1st of December was that what had been scheduled as the middle scheme for environmental land management, the local nature recovery scheme, its objectives would now be met by enhancing the existing countryside stewardship scheme rather than DEFRA inventing an entirely new scheme with all the risks and so on that have attended new schemes in the past. That is, to my eye, simply a matter of pragmatic judgment of risk, building on an existing system that will then need to see major change, rather than inventing a new system that wasn't to have seen the light of day for 12 months yet from now. That's what's been announced. What we wait for then is to understand much more about how all that will actually work, how the transformation for the higher level habitat creation will work, how the local priorities in that will work. But we now have the conclusion to that process of looking at the means to achieve the ends.
What do you see as the pros and cons of rolling the local nature recovery scheme into the existing countryside stewardship scheme?
It's a balance in all of this, and that's why it's right to talk about pros and cons. We've changed labels before in this. At one point, there was to be a single environmental land management scheme with different tiers. But Tier 1 became Sustainable Farming Incentive, and Sustainable Farming Incentive is being carried forward. So there are going to be more standards in that unrolled as we go into 2023, broader than the soil standards and moorland that we have at the moment. That was what you could do while farming. Local nature recovery and was to be about more serious, more significant change. And so I would tend to talk about that as what you could do alongside or instead of farming. So not incompatible always with farming, but at the top end, much more serious habitat change. And the focus in that is on nature, and the focus on that is in local. So there would be different priorities in different areas, but it would cover off at the top end woodland creation, peatland restoration, some of the government's serious habitat creation objectives, as well as things more compatible to run alongside farming. And then beyond that, you have the collaborative side for landscape recovery, which has got itself launched. The government is reasonably well pleased with that. So looking at local nature recovery, those local and nature objectives, the work done to date on local nature recovery seems to have been quite hard to crystallize. The first trials in this were not, or first tests in this were not likely to be seen until later next year, which is getting quite late in the programme. That suggests that there are a number of problems in bringing it together, even with all the work that has been done. So you've got a risk of an unfounded scheme coming quite late in the day. Countryside stewardship is a scheme that DEFRA has substantially revised, has now attracted significant farmer entry, something like 35,000 farmers in it, and it gives a platform on which to build for those larger demands and those local demands. And evolving that, I think, will still have significant challenges. but it's doing it from a known base with a known brand, and to that extent looks to have greater capacity to achieve more with less risk. And that's the balance, and it's the balance DEFRA has struck, and it looks a reasonable answer.
Now, the government was meant to announce its environmental targets by October the 31st. When are you now expecting them?
Yes, these are the targets under the Environment Act, and they cover off air quality, species abundance, and a number of other topics like that. And the Environment Act said that they had to be set by the end of October. That's a statutory requirement. We had a full consultation on these back in the spring and have been waiting for the answers. And clearly one of the issues that's delayed it has simply been the turnover of ministers. Theresa Coffey spoke about this, though, to the EFRA committee in the House of Commons the other day, and some of the conversation began to look as though there were actually some questions about whether the targets were now being seen to be more demanding than was easily deliverable. They are anyway expected to be demanding. They are expected to achieve improvement in water quality or tree cover or the various other goals that were being set. But whether there are now practical problems emerging. But in her answers in the Commons, she's clearly expecting to be able to give the targets in very shortly, and it's clearly a matter for embarrassment for government that they've not met a statutory deadline. The new Office for Environmental Protection, which has been created precisely to monitor government, has made clear that this is a bad idea, not meeting statutory targets, and the government is now going into the United Nations Biodiversity Conference with this as outstanding business, which again is an embarrassment. So all the pressures are there for them to come out with what they can come out with. Whether the targets that are set will be quite as demanding as those that were consulted on, we will remain to see.
You've touched on the delays. There's been a lot of anger expressed by some organisations saying that DEFRA is betraying its environmental commitments. Is that something that you agree with?
No. And I think this is a whole area where, for a mix of different reasons and motives and misunderstandings, people have looked for betrayal, people have looked for backsliding where none was ever meant. To some extent, the rapid review of agricultural policy became a flashpoint for other concerns elsewhere at around the time of the September financial statement. But if there's one thing that is perhaps most remarkable about agricultural and environmental policy coming through from DEFRA is how consistent it's been over the last quite a number of years. So actually, you could look back even 15, 20 years in this area, but certainly since Health and Harmony consultation, February 18, labels change, some of the language moves, but you run with these twin objectives of improving farming productivity and improving the environment. And they need to be seen in harness. And in many ways, ministers are right, whether it was the previous Secretary of State, whether it's George Eustace, whether it's Ranulf Jayawardena, or indeed Therese Coffey now, when they paint these as symbiotic, that good farming and good environment more often go together than they are in tension. But when you have a speech that talks about the environment, people wonder where we're going on food security and productivity. When you have a speech on productivity and food security, then people wonder whether the environment's being abandoned. And I think people do need to take a deep breath, step back, take a look at the larger picture, and see that DEFRA is not wavering in its objectives. It is dealing with the very real practical problems of how you implement the very demanding changes we're looking at. But there wasn't the cause for people to think that we were about to have a bonfire for the environment. And it doesn't actually, I think, help reasoned discussion of the right ways to achieve the objectives for us to have these periodic and largely confected arguments.
At the CLA conference, Therese Coffey also made mention of water pollution. Given that DEFRA has finally announced details of the slurry investment grant, which will help farmers to improve their slurry storage facilities, do you see that as an indication of bringing together both carrot and stick in future?
Oh, very much so at this point. And it's what she also said to the Commons Committee the other day. What we have is, I think across the United Kingdom, in all governments, but here with DEFRA talking specifically about England, we had last year a snapping of tolerance over water pollution. We have the major challenges being made to the lack of investment in sewage facilities by the water companies, but that doesn't exonerate farming from this. The Welsh government has said broadly, come rain, come shine, come pandemic, come war, there are three pollution incidents a week. we must deal with this. And that's what they're doing with the water resources work in Wales. Here in England, very much indicating a desire to help people who could be problems from being problems. But then the stick of enforcement as the Environment Agency comes and fines and prosecutes people. And despite some of the press coverage, there's more of that going on than perhaps is reported. But equally, we have on the table now in England, and much more generously than in either Wales or Scotland, we have the offer of up to £250,000 on a 50% basis to deliver for a dairy farm, a beef farm, a pig farm that uses a slurry system to deliver 6 months covered slurry storage. And that is a big offer from government. And it's first off, this is the first of these schemes coming through, more are promised. And I would commend anybody who envisages being in those sectors, having a viable business for the next decade, to look very, very hard at those schemes, because I would anticipate that before too long, 6 months covered storage will be mandatory. And at that point, it won't be a question of there being government support for this at all. So I see this as a serious window to look at. And at this point, with the covered storage there, this is not only about water pollution, it's about air quality. And we've had the chief medical officer's report out on air quality and pollution. And agriculture's contribution to that is ammonia. And most of that comes from livestock farming and manure practices. And a significant fraction of that can be handled by covering slurry stores. And again, the Welsh scheme, the Scottish scheme, the English scheme have cover within them to reduce that element of air pollution. And you can only expect this to become more stick and less carrot with time. Here, you're being given a chance to have really significant sums of money to put a farm right. Now is the moment.
Now, the scale back in BPS is meant to be funding these environmental schemes. Therese Coffey has refused to announce payment rates so far. Do you think there's enough money in the pot to attract farmers to apply?
I think we're moving to the point where there probably should be a useful amount of money in the pot. We're at a very interesting cusp where people are now getting more interested in what the new world might look like, but we haven't yet taken that much money from basic payment to fund it. So in a sense, all the people who would be arguing for a slower phasing out of basic payment are living with the fact there's less money for the new schemes, and that leads to an unfulfilled appetite for information. Broadly, people lost 5% in 2021. They've lost 20% in 2022. That's beginning to release some significant funds. There's another tranche, significant tranche, being taken in 2023. That's beginning to get to around a third of the pot of money that was in basic payment available for these schemes. That gives significant leeway, I think, for putting money in. We didn't get the uprating in countryside stewardship and SFI till into this year. I think there are some serious challenges probably about how you actually do the pricing for schemes in current markets. But we've been told we will get the prospectus with payment rates in the new year. There will doubtless have been a lot of backroom crawling over them to look and see. We hope that there's more of a transactional element in this. And by that, I mean, they want to buy these changes from people. Are they pricing them well enough that farmers will want to sell them? So it's not just compensation. It's something that goes further to achieve the changes in land management that DEFRA will want. And that will be an interesting question to look at in this. But in answer to your question, I think it's only going to be in 2023 that a significant amount of money will be available to do the funding. And then more will come in 24 and thereafter. This is a rolling process. But there isn't extra money to put in the pot. This money has to come from basic payment. And if it's not yet been taken, then it can't yet be paid.
Outside of environmental farming, food production is in a bit of a precarious state right now. Supermarkets are rationing and importing eggs. They're blaming bird flu for the shortage, but we know that's not true. What is your take on the outlook for food production in the coming months?
I think we're at a very interesting point. And by interesting, I think I mean it in the Chinese sense, for some of our higher value production sectors. And this, I think, is really quite worrying. More generally, the broadacre commodity sectors are benefiting from strong world commodity markets. Just sort of twice in a generation, the wheel comes round and very strong demand and constraints about supply and low world stocks can come together and drive strong markets for commodity producers. Arable men for the 2022 harvest will have had a good run in almost all cases. Their input costs will be much more serious for the 23 harvest, and of course that's a story that's yet to run. Livestock men have had good markets, but there are more issues around input costs to watch, so a little tighter. But I am really looking much more seriously at fruit, vegetables, potatoes, onions, field-scale veg, horticulture, pigs, poultry. And those all add up in 2021 to 31%, effectively a third of the value of our agricultural output ex-subsidy, off quite a relatively small area of land used to produce those. And they sustain downstream processing and upstream supply trades that are also important parts of the economy. We produce those crops and livestock and eggs because we have the processing and the markets, but also those exist because we're there. And it's twofold. The concern is that we are looking at inadequate pricing for the risk and reward that they face. And while, as you say, just looking at eggs, yes, there has been impact from bird flu. That, I think, is best understood as dramatically increasing the risk for producers. The real shifts in market, the real loss of 5 million or so egg-laying birds already, is from producers contracting their volume in response to rising feed costs, rising energy costs, without an adequate recompense in pricing for those costs and for the risk involved. Similarly, if you go into field-scale vegetables, you're looking at very significant increases in input costs, much higher need for working capital, the existing risks that are around production yields, and prices that have not responded to that. And that cap on pricing in the marketplace, and prices have generally risen, but they've not risen by enough to compensate for the pressures that are being faced. And so you're now seeing, as we've seen fewer laying birds for eggs, we are seeing declining areas being cropped. The British onion crop, we have data for that. That fell 10% for 2022 in area, 25% in terms of production. I would think from talking with field-scale vegetable producers, we are looking at more significant cuts still when we look at cropping for 2023. And that's reducing volume in key sectors of the agricultural economy. We're looking at glasshouses that are simply looking at energy costs and labor shortages and saying, well, we're just not producing now. We can't even open the glasshouse. This, I think, is really quite problematic. And it's that fundamental business relationship between cost and risk on one side and reward on the other. And we've got that wrong at the moment. It's a very difficult time to look at markets to say we've got it wrong because of the cost of living more generally. But it's fundamental for these sectors if we're looking at them for producing the food for the future.
So what do we need to see happen here? That balance between food security and the cost of living crisis. Should the government intervene?
I think there's probably more to be done in terms of the framing of mood music with the major retailers and processors. We have powers under the Agriculture Act for sectors to be investigated. And there has been studies on contracts in dairy and pigs. We have the tool, possibly more, could be made more useful, of the groceries code adjudicator. But we have a phrase that somebody used to me 3 or 4 years ago, is that processors took the farmer's margin, the supermarkets took the processor's margin, and then the supermarkets cannibalized their own margins. We've got a domestic food market that seems, on the whole, even with the extent to which one part of it will blame another part of it, appears to be weak on margin. I was at a conference the other day where the banking speaker was referring to some of his account holders finding it more profitable to find export markets than to sell into the domestic market. And I think this is where a rebalancing is needed if we are to look at supplying it in the way that we would like to supply it. And frankly, all the great and the good who talk about the importance of fruit and vegetables in the national diet and how we should be able to make money supplying it need to come down and start looking at the basic economics of this if they want to deliver their end. Because otherwise, it's all going to be supplied from abroad, and that will simply be where we have reached by the accumulation of all our own actions.
So is there anything that farmers can do to help themselves here?
There's an old Victorian joke that the next best thing after presence of mind in a railway accident is absence of body. And where farmers are reacting perfectly reasonably, is reducing their exposure to risk. It is the poultry shed that's not being restocked. It is the reduced potato cropping area. It is people focusing on the best land that will best support a margin that will help carry overheads. Yes, it's then looking at marketing. It's looking at the processes you can control. It's improving efficiency, looking at other strands of income. But this is an exercise in risk management. And we may have passed the point where this is an exercise in resilience. This now is looking at ways to reduce exposure to risk where there is no reward. The damaging thing about that is, will we then have the capacity, the infrastructure, the skills, the machinery to be able to recover production should the wheel turn? And I think that's a question that faces us pretty directly at this point.
You mentioned exports. We had George Eustace's admission that the Australian free trade deal was a complete disaster. There is some glimmer of hope in the Northern Ireland Protocol. What's the latest news on that?
Well, just pausing probably first on trade deals, I think it is probably realistic to say that we've been watching a government learning its mistakes by doing. The then minister, now the ex-prime minister who was negotiating those deals, felt it was more important to get a deal through on a given time than to have the best deal that could be negotiated. And that is a weak position from which to be negotiating. And what I've seen over the last 2 or 3 years is, I think, a gaining of experience by practical bruising in terms of how you negotiate with people who are skilled international negotiators. So the Australian deal probably represents part of that learning curve from which we hope people have learnt in future. Because the Northern Ireland Protocol is, of course, not strictly about exports. This is about matters within the UK's single market. And it is a structure which, for various reasons, the EU protecting the integrity of its single market south of the Irish border, and the UK protecting the integrity of its single market north of the Irish border, arriving at rules for goods to go from outside the EU in Great Britain to inside the EU single market in Northern Ireland. And that's posed quite a number of challenges, because the default is to really very serious and bureaucratic cross checks, putting major pressures on things like veterinary medicines going into both Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. We've had particular issues where we've achieved easing of the rules for getting second-hand machinery, agricultural machinery, into Northern Ireland, which has been a significant buyer for farmers in this country. Issues over getting seeds into Northern Ireland, but also issues for Northern Ireland producers who send livestock over here for auctions, who could then not get it back if it failed to sell. Again, a weak negotiating position. So where we are on the protocol is that it's not being enforced in the way that it's written. It's being enforced with quite a lot of easing, most of which we're just doing, but the EU are accepting. But at some point, there's a default to a much more rigorous and difficult regime. We have had several rounds of negotiation that broadly haven't got anywhere. But the understanding from conversations at the moment is that the mood music with the new government is a lot easier. There's a level of realism and pragmatism coming through, perhaps particularly from Southern Ireland, which, of course, is wound up in this to a considerable extent. There's pressure on now on both sides, not just on us from the Americans, and that enormously powerful political force of fatigue. Weariness with the issue. And we're all working very much together in supporting Ukraine, and that is encouraging other habits of cooperation. So while I think there aren't formal negotiations at the moment, I think there are background conversations. The mood music is a lot better. It is quite possible that we could have an answer by, let's say, Easter, which would then facilitate the new elections in Northern Ireland and the very important return to Northern Ireland of a government, of ministers and an assembly, which they have now been lacking, which is then frustrating necessary policy development in Northern Ireland. So I would hope that if we were doing this interview in 4 or 5 months' time, we would be looking at a much more comfortable picture.
That's good to hear. We'll look forward to that. Just taking it back a couple of weeks to the Chancellor's financial statement, did that offer any comfort to rural residents, in your view?
Yes, though there's a lot more that needs to come. which is perhaps the theme of this podcast. The first thing is it brought order back to lending markets. The comparison between the September financial statement under Liz Truss and the Sunak Jeremy Hunt statement of November 17th is remarkable. Within 55 days, we've moved the fiscal position by £100 billion. £45 billion was being given away in September. £55 billion is to be taken back from November. That is, on any measure, simply extraordinary. But after the September statement, we had what the markets and the press cheerfully called the moron premium on interest rates, which took 10-year money up from 3.1%, 3.2%, up to 4.4% and 4.5%. So you began to see people talking about mortgages at 6% and above and where that might go. And all that's disappeared. We're now back where we were on a tide of, yes, of rising interest rates, but they're rising in Germany, they're rising in the States, they're rising across the world. They're actually just going back at the moment to the bottom end of what was historically normal. But we're now in normal markets, markets beginning to give the government a bit of tolerance. The government the other day got away with a sale of debt that was over three times oversubscribed. So that's markets beginning to show confidence again in government. It was a very testing frolic that will have taught all other governments quite a lot at our own expense, because all other governments are increasing expenditure on the back of COVID, on the back of the energy shock. We have just shown what you shouldn't do. But we have now come back from that. So stable lending markets, I think, are an important thing all round, whether you're borrowing to buy agricultural land, whether it's the overdraft you've got to fund the working capital for your crop going in this autumn, or whatever else it is. Very little in the general measures is then particularly rural at that point. So it's the wider economy. And so that matters. Those are the people who buy the food and so on. The measures I would pick out, firstly, the annual investment allowance that's available for sole traders, for partnerships, for businesses, particularly useful for the small businesses that dominate farming. And this is the amount of spending you can do on qualifying plant and machinery in a year that you can set off against tax in that year. And that has been a very variable figure and quite often varied on short notice. It's been as low as 25,000. And it has been on a hand-to-mouth basis for the last 2 or 3 years at a million. If no decision were taken at the end of next March, it would drop to 200,000. So we're looking at farmers short of labour, needing to be efficient, needing to modernise, needing to spend money on plant and machinery, robotic milking, automation and all the other things, and not knowing, in truth, where their tax position in the end depends on the supply chain and its ability to deliver. This is not a good position to be in to plan. And all three statements by chancellors this autumn, so we've been piling them up, have all said it's to be made permanent at a million. Now, you might like it to be more, but having it permanent at a million is an enormous reassurance for stability. We want to be able to buy the right automation, the right IT, when it's ready and right for the business, not to be driven to meet a tax hurdle to buy something that's not quite as good as it might be, or indeed to run for it and then fail to get the tax relief we'd planned on getting. So that, I think, is good news. It's something we've been asking the Treasury for quite some time. The other good news is silence. And it's silence on capital gains tax. There was a lot of pressure on the Chancellor and a lot of gossip that he would increase the rates of capital gains tax to income tax rates. So up from 20% to, for many people, maybe 40%. That runs against Sunak's thinking when he was Chancellor and Hunt's thinking evidently now. And it's very important for business to have stability in those areas, and that it allows for the issues around large-scale capital disposals, then large-scale capital reinvestment. And the silence on that is very welcome indeed, because that was probably the moment of maximum risk for something to change around CGT. He has cut the personal allowance. So if you're doing a small disposal of land, a small share sale, then the 12,300 available this year will become 6,000 next year, will become 3,000 the year after. So at that level, you want to have done your disposals before the end of March rather than afterwards. But for the big picture stuff, to have the status quo on capital gains taxes, I think really quite valuable. For hospitality, leisure and retail in England, there's a 75% rates relief. So for the village pub, for the village shop, for a leisure activity on a farm, where that's exposed to rating, then there's three quarters relief on rating up to 110,000. And that should give comfort to some areas that are very pressed on energy costs, have been through difficult years. And that is help. and help to be taken.
That brings us neatly on to the much promised levelling up plans. There are concerns that these are falling apart at the seams. Can you give us any insight into what's going on?
Well, we've got the Levelling Up and Regeneration Bill in Parliament at the moment, and it is working its way through, and lots of government intentions to keep adding things to it. We've got the government intentions, which are, it covers all sorts of things, from reorganising local government to provide unitary government with mayors, deals around that, material on planning, material on compulsory purchase, right the way through to a whole range of other subjects. The real pressure here, it's around planning and housing, and this is now a massive flashpoint. And we have a crisis in terms of how we house our people. If we take international comparisons, we are 2 million houses light for the population that we have. And that reveals itself in all sorts of problems. It's the pressure on the let sector. It's the issues then over short lets and holiday homes and second homes. It's the pressure of affordability in housing. It's then the difficulties that imposes on people looking to be able to take jobs. Why is the age of a first-time buyer, I think I saw, has now gone up to 37? These are striking issues of challenge. The government has tried in several ways to ease this. There was a major radical fresh think on planning 2 years ago, and that died the death at the hands of backbenchers after the Chesham by-election. We have had 50 or 60 backbenchers, Tory backbenchers, saying that local authorities shouldn't be told to have any houses they should build, and they shouldn't be told that they must have 5 years land supply. That has led to significant negotiation, and the government is effectively conceding much on that to the rebels, which in terms of where the housing pressure is greatest, will do nothing to help that. What's also happened is we have had other pressure from others to be a little more liberal for onshore wind. David Cameron set his face against onshore wind. It all became very politically controversial. It's actually a very efficient means of producing the energy that we're going to need in large quantities. So please, we want it from anywhere we can get our hands on it. And onshore wind can be part of that mix. This looks like giving local authorities much more freedom to be able to approve new onshore wind, repowered onshore wind, and the connections for it, but probably without a right of appeal. And that gets us right back to the conundrum in all of this, which is a government that is minded to see local planning run by local consent, when local consent is normally not forthcoming for development. We are about to get a consultation paper on how you achieve local consent. It'll be interesting to see it. I would be rather surprised if it was effective, but we shall see. But we're in the extraordinary position of what I've called development by forked tongue. We have a policy of being very generous, of localism, of consent, street votes, rent auctions, all these various things coming through. We're going to have community land auctions and so on, all of which fail to meet development targets. And then we enlarge permitted development rights to change the uses of other properties, of retail and farm buildings and offices and so on. We've created 82,000 homes by that route outside the planning system. And so the official planning policy doesn't function. And the unofficial one isn't yet at a scale big enough to deliver what we need. But at root, we have got bigger problems than the policies outlined are going to answer. And that is a real challenge, and nobody is yet really tackling those issues, though with Michael Gove, we do have somebody who is more committed to delivery than many ministers.
It really feels like we're facing a time of serious stagnation without an awful lot of sign that the government will pull us out anytime soon. What can rural businesses do to take back some control, or is it just a case of waiting it out?
Well, I think we can take your question at two levels. The first one about we as a country, it could look as though we are not yet ready to accept the change that will be needed to have the economic growth that will answer these questions. Classically, it's about business investment, it's about innovation, it's skills, but it's about planning, so it becomes about housing our people. It's about accepting that we need very substantial energy generation and then energy distribution. The changes that will come to the way that we make houses energy efficient a whole run of these things with the environmental standards, with the energy needs, so that we actually have cheaper energy than Mr. Putin is giving us, so that we have the growth. There's a very stark chart from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, a very well-regarded think tank, and it shows real household disposable incomes on a rising curve, pretty stable, from 1948 to 2008. Since 2008, it's gone sideways. That curve would have gone up. We're already well behind that curve. What that chart shows is that by 2026, we will be a third poorer than we would have been if we'd had historic levels of growth from 2008. And yet we have all our aspirations that we want to fund from health services and defence and living standards and the rest. And it's finding the way to do that. And it would seem, and this is where you would look for political leadership, but it would seem that we are not yet willing to accept the changes that will be needed to do that. So that's the national picture. We have gone through issues like this before. You know, we did. There was a will in 1940 and a will in 1945, very clearly a national mood that the 1979 government caught. We're not there at that point yet. In 2010, the nation accepted the message that there wasn't the money and we had austerity. And that was accepted and understood. And we need to be at one of those moments again. And it's not yet crystallized in those ways. For rural businesses, it's, again, that mix of knowing what you can control. A lot of the wider policy picture is outside your control. What you can control is making your business better. What you can control is looking at the investment that will protect it for the future, looking at who are the best people within the business to manage it, looking at how far you can automate to be able to reduce labor costs. There may be financial restructuring to do. It depends where you are, different businesses in different situations. But looking at, if you're looking at farms, it's the mix of enterprises. Are there other income streams that you can actually look at and sensibly develop rather than just having failed at one thing, then try to fail at another? It comes back to looking at your business, where you want to be in 10 years' time, and finding your own path to that, taking good advice, but acting earlier rather than later. You can be distracted by talk of carbon. You can be distracted by talk of private markets and this, that, and the other. You can be distracted by waiting to see what a government scheme will offer you. The real thing to sort out is your own business.
Oh, thank you so much for your time, Jeremy. It feels like a good place to stop. It's easy to feel frustrated by the lack of leadership seen in this country recently. But as you say, in changing times, those who are proactive, forward-thinking, and act now will be able to take charge of their own destiny rather than relying on the government to do it for them. CAAV advisors are clearly here to help, and members can access detailed briefing notes with full information on the CAAV website. So, Jeremy, thank you once again for joining the podcast. And there we are. We've reached the end of yet another episode of the CAAV podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, or indeed catch up on previous ones, please head to our website, or you can subscribe for free on whatever platform you use. Also, if you have any feedback or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch by emailing us on enquire@caav.org.uk. That's it for today. So until the next time, thank you very much for listening. Bye for now.